Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, last year I was finally pregnant, and now I'm finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. Hello there. How are you doing? Can you believe this is the final episode of the series? I can't believe it. Genuinely. My God, where has the time gone? I have so enjoyed chatting to loads of fabulous women in this series, all with different experiences, but all who have a common bond and one that I know you listening resonate with too. And I did say women because it has been all women, but I promise there will be some men in the next series because there definitely is going to be a next series. Whoop, whoop. I know when I was pregnant, I really wanted to hear stories from others who understood that whilst getting those two lines on a pregnancy test was wonderful, like the very best news, it isn't the end of the journey. Being pregnant after infertility and loss can be excruciatingly difficult because of the anxiety and the worry that comes with that. Knowing that and hearing from so many of you that you felt the same, that was the inspiration for this podcast back in 2019. And I am so proud of how far it has come. I really am. And that we will be back, like I say, for series 5 in the summer too, which is just, oh, I'm so happy, and I've got some amazing guests lined up for you as well. As many of you know, the work that I do to support the Finally Pregnant and parenting community is my passion, but it's also over the last year become my work too, ever since I've kind of come back, I guess, from maternity leave. I am so lucky to be able to make this happen, but obviously, financially, I need to make it work. So if you have enjoyed this series or any of the episodes of the Finally Pregnant podcast and fancy buying me a coffee, just a coffee, to show your appreciation, I have popped a link to a fab site called Ko-fi, or coffee, I guess it is, K-O-F-I. And yeah, if you fancy buying me a coffee, it would be amazing. If you've done that already, thank you so much. It is massively appreciated. And if you are going to head over now or do it over the next couple of weeks or so, I just want to say a huge thank you in advance because, yeah, it really is very special. And the longer that I can continue to do this, you know, I just want to keep doing it forever, really, I suppose. If you can't afford it, please know that I totally understand. Please, please do not worry. And I'm here for you either way. I really, really am. Over to today's episode, where I am chatting to journalist and author Alex Holder. As you will hear, Alex had her first child easily, which is amazing. However, when it came to having a sibling, she has been on a pretty long journey. The great news is that Alex is currently 8 months pregnant, so the little one is almost here. And we sat down a few weeks ago to talk about her trying to conceive journey and how she is feeling being finally pregnant. We also talk about amniocentesis, which isn't something that she's had in this pregnancy, but she did in her first. And so it's really interesting to hear from someone who has been through that. All is well. Yeah, it's a really important conversation, I think. And the first time we've discussed it in this way on the podcast. So I'm really grateful to Alex for doing that. Alex has lots of embryos in storage, which she will unlikely use. And I know that this topic of what happens to unused embryos has come up a lot recently. If you haven't seen it already, I did have a conversation with the amazing senior clinical embryologist and IVF lab director, Christiana Antoniadu. You can view it on my IGTV, over on my Instagram, or on my YouTube channel. And I will put links to both of them in the show notes. Something else that myself and Alex talk about is the cost of IVF. And as it happens, I read an article just this week about people who aren't able to afford fertility treatment, who are turning to fundraising sites to hopefully pay for treatment. And the article was about the shame they feel for doing that. And that shame is on top of the shame that so many feel for needing treatment in the first place. And it's such a difficult situation and one that we need to keep talking about. And if you are out there and the financial impact of fertility treatment is affecting you, I want you to know that you are not on your own and that you should not feel that shame. And actually, I wanted to read you a quote from Brené Brown, which felt really apt. And I think when I read it, then you will understand why, not only because of the shame, but also the reference. You'll get it. If you put shame in a petri dish, it needs three ingredients to grow exponentially: secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you put the same amount of shame in the petri dish and douse it with empathy, it can't survive. Remember, whatever stage of this journey you are on, you are not alone. Like, you're really, really not. I am here and there is a huge community here for you. If you aren't on Instagram already, please do head over there. You don't have to be public. You don't even need to post, but following others who are sharing their journey will help you feel not alone. If you are finally pregnant and parenting and Instagram doesn't feel like the right place, or you want to do both, please come and join the Hangout, where you can be part of the amazing support groups with the most wonderful and supportive women, or the yoga sessions, which is a unique 4-week yoga course for those who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. And they are as much about the community with weekly check-ins as they are about the incredible pregnancy yoga taught by just the most amazing humans. Plus, on my website, you can find meditations. You can also sign up for my top 5 strategies to help you enjoy your pregnancy and so, so much more. So please head over to my Instagram or my website. As I said, all the links will be in the show notes. You are not alone. That is it for this season, other than the conversation that I'm about to share with you with the wonderful Alex. Thank you so much for all of your incredible support, as always. The messages, the emails, the DMs, it means so much to me. I really hope that you enjoy today's conversation and all of the conversations I've had, like I say, with my wonderful guest. And a huge thank you to them for sharing, because I couldn't do it without them. Really, I couldn't. And I look forward to seeing you all again really soon. Take care. Bye-bye. Before we start, time for a quick ad break. Knowing your fertile days are so important if you are trying to get pregnant or trying to avoid it. With the Mirror Fertility Tracker, you will know your fertile window up to 6 days. It is the only tracker on the market that provides you an accurate and personalized ovulation analysis by tracking your LH and estrogen hormone levels. Find out more at miracare.com. There's a link in the show notes, and get £25 off your tracker with the code FINALLYPREGNANT. Hi there, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, very well. And really looking forward to our chat. Thank you so much for joining me all the way from Lisbon, in fact, where you now live. It would be amazing to hear about who you are and what you do.
So I'm Alex Holder. I am a writer in a few different guises. I write for brands. I also write for newspapers and magazines, mainly, I guess, women's interest. So I write to Elle. I write for Grazia. And then also The Guardian and The Telegraph. Yeah, and I also wrote a book called Open Up, which is all about, I guess it's a manifesto to encourage people to talk about money in their everyday lives with their work colleagues, with their friends, with their family.
Amazing. And we were talking before about how actually quite liberating it is talking about money. And we will talk about money in regards to IVF during this conversation, which some people can feel nervous about. Some people, like, there's just so many mixed emotions around that. But to start with, it would be really great if you could talk to us. You have a little boy already, and it would be amazing if you could talk to us about your journey to parenthood, to have him, and you are currently 29 4 weeks pregnant, which is wonderful, with an IVF baby. So yeah, just talk to us a little bit about your story, if you would.
Okay, so going back, I had my son Cass. He came so easily. I didn't realise how easily at the time, obviously. I was 31, and I think he came after 2 months of peeing on ovulation sticks. I'd been quite exposed to a lot of infertility in my social circles, so I was aware of it. But yeah, it wasn't something at the time that I'd experienced. My main issue with my first pregnancy was that I almost went from being a workaholic party girl to being pregnant. That was like what I dealt with at the time. And then he was born and I continued to deal with that. And I actually had the coil put in because I presumed that, yeah, what, you know, preventing a pregnancy was the thing that I had to think about. And then when he was 2.5, I had the coil removed and started to try naturally. I immediately went to peeing on ovulation sticks. I was never very good at kind of sitting back and just letting it happen. And then kind of each month was rolling by, and eventually it got to 2 years and nothing had happened.
That's a long time. Like, that's a long time for anyone. But if you had previously got pregnant quite quickly and now you're wondering, and as I'm learning more and more, you know, people are aware of the age gaps between children, and like, where do you go? You said that you had been exposed to infertility, so you hopefully had people that you could talk to at this stage.
So me and a friend had both removed our coil in the same month, which I now realise is a slightly ridiculous thing to do, although, you know, it's the things you talk about. And I think it's when I'd realised that she'd gone through a foot, you know, she had her baby in her arms, and it was kind of a marker of the time. And I'd gone to see a fertility clinic in London, recommended by friends that had been there. And I think it cost about £250. And I felt like we got nothing out of it. It was very much, I think that was after about 13 months. So it was like, we'd just gone over that threshold of it's been a year. And we were almost told to just keep trying. You know, you've already had a kid, it's probably nothing. I think at that point, I just knew that we were going to need some treatment. But we weren't, I was very naive. I hadn't spent any time in the forums by this point. I didn't know what treatment or like what test to ask for. So we literally just paid for a chat and left. And I didn't feel like I left with any information other than, oh, maybe I should make my partner, not make him, he was with me in the appointment. Maybe he should get his sperm tested. So then I think a few more months, I found actually the emotional hurdle of paying for it, I found that really hard to get over. It's like, it feels like you're unlocking something. The moment you truly admit that you need help and that you're going to pay for it, I found really difficult. And especially as you just think one more month, one more month, one more month, and then until those months had added up.
It's so interesting that you say that. I was talking to someone for the podcast just this week, and we were talking about the fact that the hurdle is that we need treatment, you know. And for me, I had 3 rounds of IUI, and I didn't have to have them, but I was offered them and I took them because it was like a stepping stone into IVF. And that, you know, so I could dip my toe in the water. But having gone, I guess, from having a baby, you know, with a roll in the hay, so to speak, to actually this becoming a financial transaction and a medical transaction and that kind of thing. Yeah, that I can understand that just must have felt so alien.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd never really been part of any private medicine before. I'd never considered private medicine was like for me. And during that time, so I'd been in London for 18 years by this point. My partner had probably been about 15 years. And we decided to move to Lisbon, very much on a whim. We'd been here once. It felt like a good lifestyle choice. I think the lifestyle of London was beginning to, it has to come hand in hand with the infertility. Ultimately, we didn't feel well. It wasn't that we were walking around, you know, unhealthy, but we knew that something was wrong with our bodies. It wasn't happening. and it felt like we were ready for a change. So we moved to Lisbon, and as soon as we moved here, I went to see a fertility clinic. And I guess also being in a foreign country where you're going to pay for private medical care anyway, that kind of helped, and it was cheaper. So immediately, you know, that first consultation, I think, was €90. And the difference between £250 for €90. So every time we went into the IVF clinic, I didn't feel like, it didn't feel like such a dent. Still a lot of money, but it wasn't. It didn't add up to the same amount. So it felt, a lot more attainable. And we did the same. We didn't get to IUI, but we did 3 rounds of Clomid with trigger shots. And actually, we were about to do IUI, but COVID kind of came in. And I'm really glad we didn't, because I don't think that ever would have worked for us. And I think that would have cost £1,000. You know, you go in these baby steps when often now, when I think about budgeting for IVF or for fertility treatment, rather, budgeting to get the baby that you want at the end, that maybe going straight in is often more financially viable than, you know, £500 by £500 over 6 months, which is the statistically how long it would take to get pregnant by IUI.
I remember absolutely gawping at spending £100 on a digital ovulation kit. And I look back now and think, I do hear you. Like, the other side of the argument is, should people be going straight to IVF? And it depends on their fertility issues. So can I ask, what do you know the reason for your infertility?
My partner had a sperm test in London before we moved, and it wasn't great. I think out of like the 7 things, he failed on 3 or 4, like count and viscosity and a couple of other, you know, the morphology. And then he had a sperm test after living in Lisbon for a couple of months, and it was great. So that could have been lifestyle. We definitely immediately drank less, chilled out with work a bit more. It's cheaper to live here. The sun shines, you know, the food is better, all those usual things. I think ultimately what it came down to is we were both just a little bit below par for our fertility. So I had, you know, the ink shot through my fallopian tubes, and I had all my like AMH tested. I'm at the low end, the very low normal end of AMH. So I think, just a little bit subpar, and it wasn't adding up.
Which, you know, in that instance, and we have unexplained infertility, you know, what else can you do but try? Can we talk about the secondary infertility and the emotions around that? And I know I did a live a little while ago, and we were talking about, you know, it's one thing. So my experience currently is that I was infertile to have my first one. I'm still infertile to have another, like, even though we've tried here and there over the last year or so. I came into parenthood and pregnancy and everything as an infertile person, and it's my normal. How did it feel coming to secondary infertility, like in an emotional way, like, and wanting to give your son a sibling, and how all of that felt?
It was hard. I never for a moment think it's as hard as primary infertility. You know, I had a child to mother at home. I was mothering, we were parents, but it felt really hard. It hit me far harder than I thought it would, actually. I guess it made me feel, even thinking about it makes me teary now. It made me feel very vulnerable in so many areas of my life. You know, I felt very exposed emotionally, because I couldn't hide how I was feeling, and it does affect everything. And I guess fertility and having children and parenting is laced through so many conversations, and it's embarrassing to feel so emotionally vulnerable all the time. So, you know, that constantly that brave face that you feel like you have to put on, because you don't want to talk about it all the time. You also don't want to make everyone else feel really awkward, but it's quite big and suffocating. Yeah, I was surprised by how hard it did feel. considering how lucky I was in so many other areas of my life. And, you know, I was grateful for that. But yeah, it was difficult.
I really appreciate your honesty there and being so open. I think often people don't know how to deal with their emotions around it. They don't know how to deal with other people. And certainly I have experienced this. I have probably been this person in my past as well, where people don't know how to deal with it as an outsider looking in, because they do inevitably say, at least you've got one. And whilst I 100% know, and I'm in that experience now, that secondary infertility is so valid, and all of my sisters have popped out two babies, you know, with very little concern, and loads of people I know have done the same or more. And I want another one. I want a sibling for Ren. Like, Ren is enough completely. However, for her, I would love a sibling. But I also, as you say, know that that this is an easier position for me because I have got someone at home who calls me mum, you know, and that is just, it does make it easier. But what about going through the treatment? So you did go on to have IVF. What about going through that and managing the hormones and managing your treatment while you have a little one running around at home? How was that?
Do you know, that was actually okay. I think it made me a better parent to my son, Cass. I was far, you know, I felt very grateful for him. So when you're having like those moments when they're being little buggers, I was able to kind of mindfully step back a bit more. In a very lucky way, I think it brought me closer to both my partner and Cass, which I can see how it could so easily have gone the other way. You know, it's a bloody roller coaster, isn't it? But it made me really grateful.
Yeah, it is hard, and that is so good. And I think that it can make or break relationships, especially if it goes on for a period of time. But even just like the intensity of treatment, it's a lot to deal with. And doing it in amongst a pandemic as well, there's even more pressure and intensity on a couple or an individual doing this. So you did go on to have IVF, and was successful the first time round?
No. So we had three egg collections. So the first egg collection, so my AMH was always low. So my egg first, I mean, I still got a decent number of eggs. I got 8 and most of them fertilized. We did 50-50 ICSI and IVF. And then we ended up with 2 blasts at day 5. And both of them were put back in. And I got a positive on my home test result. And then when I went for the blood test, it came really low. And then when I went for the repeat blood test, it was lower. So ultimately, it was a chemical pregnancy. I took it as a miscarriage. It felt, because I'd had 10 days where I was joyously pregnant, it had worked. You know, I felt pregnant. I believed I was. And again, that was another really hard moment, because I think you lead up to IVF and you think it's going to be the answer.
Totally. Yes, yes. You really do, don't you? Right, that's it. I'm going to get pregnant. Lovely.
And you know the stats. You know, so both me and my partner are 37 when we were trying. So we knew where we were. We knew it was at about a 30% chance with kind of, you know, all our help. If you put our data into a spreadsheet, that's what would come out. But I wasn't prepared for, I think I was prepared for it not working, and I was prepared for it working. I believed it was going to work, if I'm honest. I wasn't prepared for feeling like it had worked and then that being taken away, which I guess is exactly the definition of a miscarriage and why so many people find it so traumatic. And then the second, so then I didn't feel like I could go through a transfer again without having some in the freezer, because to come out of one, I felt like I was getting older every month. You know, you believe that it's age, and I was looking at kind of just kept one. I knew that I was I'll turn 38 just after having this baby. And, you know, there's that threshold when then the stats, I was quite obsessed with the stats. I actually think that's a good place to be because at least you get something to focus on. Something like, because it's all, otherwise it's just a mad gamble. So I read a lot about embryo banking and this idea that while I was as young as possible, I should get embryos in the freezer. In Portugal, they don't do PGS testing. They're not quite at like the forefront, because there's lots of ethical laws here. So therefore, they're not quite at like the forefront of offering every service. And I guess part of their ethics is, yeah, they don't want people testing gender or testing for various chromosomal abnormalities before putting an embryo back. So I knew that we'd be like dealing with, you know, a data of like 1 in 6 good blasts would result in a baby. So I did a second round. That time we got 4 blasts and they all went in the freezer. And then I did a third round. And this round, maybe my body got used to the drugs. I don't know if this happens, but I got more eggs, better quality blasts. And I think we actually got 6 in the third round. And 2 got put back in, froze the others. And it began as a twin pregnancy. So it began as twins. So that first scan was quite, you know, you see the 2 sacs. And then I went back for another scan a week later and there was no heartbeat in either of them. And so basically I spent the whole weekend on the internet and found all the reports that said at the exact date of gestation that I was, there was an 8% chance of a heartbeat kind of, you know, coming. And anyway, thank God, but I was in that 8%. And the heartbeat on this baby didn't appear till 6.5 weeks, which is a little bit later than normal.
I think that it's amazing that we know, you know, like all the days and how, like, it's all so early, isn't it? And I think in many ways, and I hear people say this, like, you know, we've seen our babies as embryos. We know exactly when they were put in us. And there's so much lovely stuff that we can take out of IVF. But then there's also that constant fear of, you know, scans and should the heartbeat be there? Knowing that it was a twin pregnancy, but then one of them didn't stick. And I had a similar situation. So Ren, we only had 1 embryo transferred and it split. So we had got to the point where there were 2 heartbeats and, you know, it was kind of 10 weeks when we lost her twin. But you hear it a lot with IVF, whether it's 2 different embryos, whether it's split. And we know because we are scanned so early. And it's a bit, it's a real catch 22, isn't it? Because we want that safety, we want that security, but it would be easier, I think personally, not to have known that it was a twin pregnancy.
I don't think, God, I mean, I'd like to think that I wouldn't be scanned so early again. And actually, because with my son, we had his abnormality scan didn't go great. And we had a real scare and we had a late amniocentesis and it all ended up fine. Once I was through those 12 weeks, because the first 12 weeks of this weren't great. I was being scanned every 5 days. The other sac kept growing. There was loads of blood in my uterus. You know, it made the first, I wasn't ever actually really, I didn't mourn the other twin. It was kind of, like you said, I would never have known if I hadn't have been scanned. It was just that it made the start of this pregnancy a lot scarier. And I was kind of put on bed rest because every scan, nothing. I never got one of those, you're all good to go. But once I had that 12-week scan and I was told it's all good, don't know where I've found like the ability to do this, but I truly haven't stressed. Even last night, I had a first ever so slightly worrying scan. It was like the 28-week scan and my baby's quite under in terms of underweight. But someone's got to fall at the, you know, below the 10th percentile on that chart. And I feel like things are well. So I'm just going to focus on that because, scanxiety is just too real.
You are so right. You're absolutely right. And if anyone has any concerns, and it's, you know, there is certainly a mother's intuition in that. But if you are concerned at any point, like to you, but to anyone listening, you know, go and get checked. But sometimes, yeah, if you feel good, trust your instinct. Can I talk to you a moment about, you mentioned there that with your first son, you had a more tricky time during the pregnancy and you did have a late amnio. Now, we went to have an amnio because of the twin situation with Ren. We couldn't do any chromosomal testing because it's...
Even with one embryo?
No, I know. This is what I said. And I got in touch with, like, I kind of work in this industry now. I got in touch with lots of people. Ultimately, someone recently actually explained this very well to me, and I'm going to try and do the job. She's actually joining me for an episode of the podcast, so we're going to talk.
Oh, about I'm interested. It. Tell me.
Ultimately, she explained that because the DNA of the second one was still in the blood, it might have shown percentages too high because it was showing for two, even though we were only testing one. Because my thought at the time was, they're the same DNA. You know, like, how, and we know that because we only had one transferred, like, so it's a fact. We knew that they were identical twins. But when Donna, who is a guest later on in the series, spoke to me, like, and she just, and it was the first time I felt like I'd got an answer to that. But yeah, it's because the percentages would be skewed because it would still be, have DNA in my bloodstream from the second twin. So that's the reason being. But we were concerned, and I don't know whether it's being in the IVF community, you know, it was something that really played on my mind, actually. I was an older mum at that point. I was 40 during my 2-week wait, so maybe that was on my mind as well. We went in, we researched amnios, and we went in to have the consultation. In our hospital, you went in to have the consultation and then you had it there and then immediately. And we went into that amniocentesis 100% we were going to do it. We had a full anatomy scan and we decided that we couldn't. You know, it's a 1 in 100 chance of miscarriage. We made the decision, actually. We'd seen our little girl. It was that scan that we found out it was a little girl. We decided, you know, come what may, we were going to crack on with this pregnancy, and we were very lucky to have a happy, healthy girl. But I'd really love if you're happy to share what that experience was like, because you did have an amnio, and how was that?
I feel like they made me more anxious than I needed to be, because now when I look at the marker that my son had, it was a single marker. So actually, often for something to be chromosomally wrong, or, you know, chromosomally different, you have to have a few markers. So I don't know if it was completely necessary, but I was first time pregnant, very anxious. And then we had the amnio. If I would have seen what an amnio was before I had it done, would I have had it done for those reasons at the time? I don't know if I would. It's quite a big needle. It ultimately is totally okay. You are reassured throughout. This baby is in front of you on a screen. You can see that they're okay. But they do take a large vial of brown liquid out of your belly. You know, that visual is still there. But then the reassurance it gave me, it was okay. And I felt completely reassured then for the rest of the pregnancy. So yeah, would I have felt that without it? I'm not sure.
No, that's it. You just, and we don't know, and we make the decisions based on what we know at the time, don't we? And one of the things that I found really interesting when we were in that consultation was, because you hear, you know, like, I don't know, in my mind, it was, you put the needle in and it's going to pop the amniotic sac. And you think that's the fear. And interestingly, our doctor talked us through that it's more likely because of infection rather than because, you know, I don't think that he'd ever had, and he's a top consultant at Adam Brooks Hospital, you know, this is his thing, but it's not the fear that you would imagine. So really researching and finding out the information and talking to your doctor is so important.
Yeah, and I guess understanding how medical procedures work, in that every medical procedure that you undertake in a hospital, you are given the stats before you undertake it. That, and they're generally, they never sound good. You know, as I was signing like my form for my first cesarean, you know, you're told this is the chance that you might lose your, you know, the baby won't make it, and we might have to perform a hysterectomy while you're under. And you're there, and you know, you have to, like, literally, they have to say those words and you have to sign it. So I think, as that was like the first time a stat was put in front of me, like the 1 in 100, I now realize that that's going into hospital for a procedure.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it. It is. For anyone who is going through this right now and is making those decisions or thinking about the fact that they're going to have to, then please do reach out, because there are people who have been through it, and talk to your medical professionals. You know, really get all the information. Research, research, research. Bring the questions into your appointment and talk to your medical professionals, because they are the people with your folder and with you sat in front of them. And that is, they are just the most important conversations when you're having to make decisions like this. Back to your story of your pregnancy. So your 12-week scan and you're feeling good. Had a little bit of a wobble around your 28-week scan, but actually making the decision that this is, that everything's okay. Like, looking forward now, really, I guess you are looking forward to your birth. How are you feeling about that?
I had a moment yesterday where I realized it's 10 weeks, which seems very soon considering how long we've waited. I'm feeling very excited. And you know what, knowing that this is my last pregnancy, I won't be going for a third. I don't God, touch wood, but I don't want to ever be a trier again. I'm truly like enjoying being pregnant, the kind of, you know, the Gaviscon sachets and the uncomfortable nights. It feels so good to have a little thing inside me kicking. And yeah, I'm very excited. I'm excited. The birth here, so I'm in Portugal, I'm in Lisbon, as I said. It's very different than the UK. So there's no midwives. It's not, I realize actually that kind of like no woman has touched my stomach. And when I go in to see my consultant, who's a male doctor, there's never a tape measure. There's never a Doppler. There's never hands on my belly. You have a scan every single time, like a mini scan, and they'll just check the heart rate and you see the baby. Yeah, it feels different. Like, I miss that female presence, actually. I miss like my belly being touched and someone going, oh, there's the head. But because I ended up having, I say an emergency C-section, but it was a C-section after 30 hours of labor with my first, this will be a C-section. I feel, yeah, very calm about that. I like that I don't even have to think about the birth, actually.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people who have IVF, not a lot, but people I talk to, you know, I do hear the theme that it's the control thing. And, you know, so much is unknown and there's so much worry, and actually having a date, knowing what's happening, that element of control is really satisfying. And I can absolutely see that being the case, for sure. I'm going to ask you something here now, because this is a topic that is coming up more and more, actually, I'm realizing. And a topic that I have been wrangling with myself at the moment, you know, over the last few weeks or so. The embryos that you have in the freezer, you've said there that you're not going to go on and have another pregnancy. You know, this is, you know, you're going to have your two, and that's wonderful. But you've got, if I do the maths, is it
eight
in the embryos in the freezer? Yeah. What have you given any thought?
Yeah, I have. Unfortunately, I don't think I could donate them to another couple. I don't feel ready for that. I feel quite attached to my DNA. But I would happily donate them to medical research. I feel definitely there's an emotional safety net having them in the freezer right now that makes everything else feel a little bit easier.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. And I remember when we transferred, who is now Ren, knowing that we had another one in the freezer. Yeah. And I hear people say that all the time, and using that last one is a big deal, because then you might have to be in a position where you are making the decision about whether you have treatment again, right from the very start, you know, all the way back. So yeah, I think there'd be a lot of people who have got embryos in the freezer nodding along to that. Yeah, safety net for sure. And it is a decision that you will, you know, like, I think that you make decisions at the right time. You know, you couldn't make a decision now almost. You're going to wait until it's the right time for you to make that decision. But I couldn't help but ask that question.
Yeah,
I hope you don't mind. I realize it isn't a question that I've asked before, particularly. And I don't think, well, certainly not in my experiences, that IVF clinics talk to people. Like, you sign the documentation, don't get me wrong. And, you know, would you donate them? Would this happen? That. And I've almost always entered those contracts with a bit, well, I can always change it, you know. Oh, yeah. But I think it's actually a really valuable conversation that we need to be talking about more, because there are a lot of people out there who, you know, draw the line at the number of children they have and do have embryos in the freezers that they have to make decisions about. And it's a huge decision. It really is, or it can be for some people. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. So having talked about your journey and your treatment and your pregnancy, a lot of what you talk about, and you have written a book in spring 2019, Open Up, as you mentioned, is about the money side of things. Now, because you got CAS, actually, you wouldn't have qualified in the UK in most, if not all, CCGs for IVF. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We did go to our GP, and yeah, we were basically told. I didn't go asking for IVF. I was more, where do you even begin? We're not getting pregnant. But yeah, it was almost like, we're not even going to have that conversation because you wouldn't qualify anyway.
Right. Really helpful. Thanks a lot for my one kind of contact with medical professional. And that's the response. Yeah, that's not what you want really, is it? And so you would have been funding this, and you did actually fund it yourself. But you mentioned before to me that it's much cheaper in Lisbon.
Say it feels much cheaper. So in total, each round with an egg collection and a transfer and then freezing the remaining embryos is about 5,000 euros. So it is cheaper, but it's not loads cheaper. I guess it's all like the additional, the scans, the kind of other appointments, the drugs were a lot cheaper, and they are subsidized here as a resident. So I think in total for three rounds of egg collection, the three trigger shots, you know, rounds of stims that I had before, which was obviously to pay to see the consultant, I estimate, I did mostly keep a list, but it turned into an estimate, about £16,000 we probably spent in total, which, I don't know, how does that compare to the UK?
Well, I think that people say, like, and I've heard various things, anywhere between £3,000 and £10,000 a round, really. But I've paid £25,000 for one round. That got me to exactly the same position as a free NHS round did, which was pregnant, but then unfortunately with an early miscarriage. It's like one of the biggest issues is that it's a postcode lottery. It means that it is dependent on where you live, mm-hmm. or the size of your wallet as to whether or not you can try for children, which is just...
It makes me so sad and so frustrated. Well, it's just something that we need to talk about. Because you can't talk about IVF, or you can't talk about fertility treatment without talking about money. It's unfortunately, because it is a business and because there is the postcode lottery, they come hand in hand as topics.
Completely, completely. And it is heartbreaking because people have to make the decision not to try, or not to continue to try, or not to try for a second because of finances. And I've spoken very like openly about the fact that we spent £40,000 to have Ren. Like, I joke now that she's not getting a birthday present until she's about 25, you know, that kind of thing, because she's like in the red already, just being born. But it's a hell of a lot of money, and it's changed our living situation massively. And another thing that I've been very open about is that I once calculated that we were in a £250,000, like that's £250,000 deficit. And that includes the 40K for the treatment, but it also includes leaving work, not returning to work in a capacity, i.e. full-time, you know, when I did decide to return to work. Bob, my husband, also, you know, stepping back from his career. And you know, so there is a lot. We live in a smaller house than we would expect. We now only have one car because our really old banger died a couple of weeks ago. and this car is not a very pretty, but it has. And the reason I talk about that is not because I need to live in a bigger house or have a flashier car or anything like that, but it now impacts my daughter and the life I can give her. And it impacts my decision, or our decision, around whether or not we would have another one. Do we give what money we have got all to Ren and give her everything we can? Or do we think actually a sibling might be more important but they won't get as much, you know, there won't be the holidays, there won't be the parties, there won't be, you know, which do sound frivolous, but actually when you're a child growing up, like they're the fun bits in some ways, aren't they?
I guess to some it is a frivolous question, and to some it's literally survival or not. So ultimately, I mean, you and I could both afford it and it worked for us. Like, we're already in a really privileged set. But so if you're suffering from infertility, I believe that it's a problem with your health, ultimately. And I guess it comes down to the question of, do we believe that having children is, you know, a human right, like the ability to reproduce is a health issue, or do we think it's a lifestyle choice? And I think this all gets wrapped up in the privilege conversation anyway, because only privilege, apart from the few people that are in the lucky postcode where you get three rounds, which is kind of what you need to be on the right side of the statistics, you are probably out of pocket, or you're going into a single chance knowing that that is your only chance, otherwise it's going to cost you money that you don't have. So it ends up being something that only privileged people can truly go for the full journey. Like I said, to get your, I think everyone should deserve to be on the right side of the stats. And therefore, only privileged people talk about it. So I'm public that I had, you know, I am pregnant by IVF. And I can, you know, I can spread that story and I can tell people, because it ultimately that was the result. And that's because I had the money to pay for it in the first place. And then I think what happens by that is that, because only privileged people can talk about it, because they're the only people that can access it, people presume it's a thing for privileged people. It's a privilege, you know, infertility is a problem of the privilege. It's a lifestyle choice. We chose to have children too late or for other reasons. And, you know, we can see by the stats that there was a Guardian article just 4 days ago that said, I think the headline was, by 2045, most couples will need assisted fertility treatment of some kind. And that's not just because we're choosing to have children later. It's because younger women now are showing that the environment is affecting their fertility too. So I'd love to, like, I think we need to talk about it, because I want people to start dismantling this, the idea that it's a choice. Nobody wants to be infertile. It feels shit. I can now say that, having experienced it, I can stand behind that. You know, I know that they say that it can feel as, you know, it can impact your health in the same way that heart disease does or a cancer scare. I think I can now nod along to that. And if you also don't have the finances, then I know from the amount of conversations and studying of kind of financial issues that financial issues affect your health as well. So you've got two things at the same time. No one's going to come out healthy and fertile out of that situation.
No, you're so right. I know that the World Health Organization do class infertility as a disease. And, you know, that's an important recognition, although I don't think it's necessarily something that's known to your average person walking down the street. I know that Fertility Network did research a while ago, and I think it's over 90% of people feel depressive symptoms due to infertility. Mm-hmm. And 42, this is the staggering one, the particularly staggering one I found when I first heard this. 42% of people who are experiencing infertility consider, you know, have suicidal thoughts. That's huge when you think about the incredible conversations that are happening around mental health. That's one of the issues that is leading to those mental health issues. Absolutely. And exactly as you say, financial. And I know particularly at the moment, because of the pandemic, lots and lots of people are really struggling financially. And that might be the difference between, you know, being able to have children or not being able to have children because of a pandemic. Never mind the disease being something that's out of your hands. Now, the pandemic is there, like the lack of control, just thinking about all of that is just going to have such a detrimental effect, isn't it?
Yeah, because when I think about, like, it worked for us in the end. But when I think what you're actually paying for, it's a chance, it's kind of hope, and it's knowing you've really tried. There would have had to have been a point where we would have decided to move on from trying. And the thought that people don't get that is just, yeah, I feel like if you're infertile and you can't afford it, I'm going to presume they're probably suffering in silence, because what is there to talk about? You know, we, as people who had access to fertility treatment, could talk about the treatment process, could talk about the service. You know, it is a business that we were, you know, we were clients almost. But if you have no, if there's no way of solving an issue, it's probably just something that you quieten down and don't speak about. So I totally, yeah, the suicidal stats doesn't surprise me.
It's kind of a taboo within a taboo, isn't it?
Yeah, it's two taboos, infertility and finances. And then both of those have huge emotional repercussions. And then also, you know, there's the other finance side, which is because it's difficult, because so many people find it difficult to talk about money, even if you can afford to enter a fertility clinic, you're probably not advocating for yourself in the way that you could be, because you find having conversations about money, or this idea that we shouldn't really be paying to have a baby anyway, feels like so ridiculous to pay for a baby, that I definitely had moments, you know, and I've done a lot of work on thinking about my emotional state around money, but moments of almost being like, yeah, whatever it costs. Like, I'm not here to talk, you know, I'm not here to nitpick between that treatment or that treatment. What's the best? Whereas actually, ultimately, there was a budget. We were going to have to end it at some point. The money wasn't indefinite. And if you could go into a clinic, I saw the Duff, you know, do you follow the Duff? It's an account on Instagram. It's a really good one. It's like very, very factual on IVF. She posted that a really good question to ask when you're in a fertility clinic discussing add-ons is, if this adds up to like almost two rounds, would I statistically be better off going for two rounds than going for one round with these add-ons? Like, if this is my budget, and ultimately we should all be going into clinics going, this is what I have to spend. What is the best way for me to spend it? And I didn't have that conversation, and I talk about money all the time. And I feel like that should, and you know, then there's the extra thing that doctors have this air about them where that's not their thing to talk about, the money bit. And if that's not, then there should be someone in the clinic who is customer facing, who sits you down and you have that conversation. You know, I'd ask about prices and like a sheet in both the London one and the Lisbon one, it'd be like this weird photocopied grey sheet would be brought out of a drawer. And actually, one of the reasons we chose our clinic in Lisbon is because the prices were on the website. And that was really important for, I felt a little bit more empowered going in.
When you spoke earlier on about being in Lisbon and how in Portugal they don't have a lot of the add-ons and they don't do the PGS testing and that kind of thing, there's something about that that is actually brilliant. Even though it could be frustrating, and if it didn't work, you might be like, oh, well, you know, what if we had had that? What if we had had that? But they don't offer it here. But there's so little research. And if anyone is in the midst of this, go to the HFEA website. They have a traffic light system about the add-ons. You know, it's very clear as to whether or not any research shows that they are worth doing. It's just like the whole industry, as you say, like we already know it's a booming industry for all the wrong reasons. We, as you mentioned there with the Guardian article, this is a growing, growing, growing industry. And we as the patients are just really quite vulnerable in this. And I think it's amazing that we are talking about it more generally, you know, and we are trying to break down the walls and the silence around infertility and having fertility treatment and that kind of thing. But you're so right with regards to the financial thing. People don't realize how much it costs. People don't, and I say, I don't know how many people are out there not pregnant, not even trying because they can't afford to try. And it just is something we need to talk about more and more, because it certainly isn't going away. And I look forward to more from you on this and hope that...
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to stop talking about IVF and money.
Good, good. Keep doing it.
Because in my clinic, there was no difference in cost between ICSI and IVF. So ICSI being them injecting the sperm into the egg. And one that meant that we could experiment. You know, we did 50-50. I didn't feel like I was paying for this service, so therefore I should use it across all the eggs. We didn't know if we needed it. We realized in the end that we didn't. But it's things like that. Like, if there's a price tag to everything, you just can't help but question, am I being upsold or is this necessary for the treatment?
And in the UK, there is definitely a price difference. Well, in my experience, there is definitely a price difference between that. And then there's ICSI, and then there's IMSI, and then there's all different things. And we're going to draw this to a close now, unfortunately, even though there's loads more we could talk about.
Can I say one more thing on the lifestyle?
Please.
Okay, so Belgium, which offers six rounds for anyone, whether you're solo mum by choice, same sex. I think if one of you has a womb, you get offered six rounds.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And I mean, I truly do believe that is what should be offered in the UK. Because the idea that people are socially infertile, like someone broke it down to me that 50% of people in heterosexual couples are socially infertile. Because generally it's one of you that is infertile and the other person wants to have a child with you. So therefore they, you know, they are choosing to have a child with someone who can't. So it's, yeah, what could happen? I'm genuinely scared for the future that the society I want to live in, I don't just want rich white people procreating.
No.
Heterosexual rich white people. Got it. Sounds terrible.
But it's true. No, it's true. And we need to do more. And I'm not sure that we'd ever get to Belgium, but we certainly need to get to the NICE guidelines of three. That would be a good place to start. Scotland does offer that. I think Wales, the last time I checked, it was a standard of two. So, you know, it was, I hate saying at least in a sentence, but I'm going to say at least it was standard, but still not enough. England is just, it is appalling. The rates of fertility treatment, depending on where you live and that whole conversation. And we need to do more. You're right. And it's a reminder to me because I feel like I don't feel as involved in that conversation as I once was. And it is a reminder to me almost about, you know, where I have come from in all of this and that I need to do more. So I will be looking out for ways that we can all continue to support the trying to conceive community in its entirety and help make that change for the future. Thank you so much, Alex, for spending time talking to me. I really, really appreciate it. And all of the links to your Instagram and that kind of thing will be in the show notes so people can contact you. I truly hope that you have a wonderful final few weeks of your pregnancy and that little one arrives safely. And we will be looking out for that on your Instagram when it does happen. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. It was very cathartic. I liked it.
Take care then. Bye-bye.
Bye.